this question much more briefly, but since it was asked in Psalm 46, I just thought, why not discuss the whole psalm? And then the question will be answered in the process. So we do want to study Psalm 46 this evening, and the question that was asked about it was, in verse 4, what does this city represent, the church or heaven? The short answer is neither. However, the holy city here is Jerusalem, but in many texts it stands for the church or for heaven. So we'll try to see how that breaks down and make some applications of that later. Psalm 46 was written by the sons of Korah. It doesn't give a specific time, but we believe from what is written, it was after the temple was built and established, sometime after that. And before we get done, we're going to try to show how that one of the verses many scholars think refers to the days of Hezekiah. Tom Waycaster wrote 7 volumes on the Psalms, and he suggests to use as an outline one that was established by a denominational person, G. Campbell Morgan. And that outline seems to work fairly well, so we'll just mention it briefly here at the outset. First of all, in the first 3 verses, there is the challenge of confidence. Where does our confidence come from? Second, there is the secret of confidence. And third, the vindication of confidence. I like the way that these are done, but we're not probably going to be referring to each one each time, but just try to remember that overall breakdown. A long time ago, I memorized Psalm 46:1. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Let's take a look at each one of these words for a moment to make sure that we have the proper concept. God is a refuge, that is a safe haven from the events that are going on in the world. The Baptist Spurgeon wrote many commentaries, and he correctly wrote about this verse. There were to be some things we would disagree, but he said about this verse, "Others vaunt their impregnable castles placed on inaccessible rocks and secured with gates of iron, but God is a far better refuge from distress than all these." I don't know what poet wrote it, but and maybe this was one of those anonymous poets that we find so often, but we find these words, "A fortress firm and steadfast rock is God in time of danger. A shield and a sword in every shock from foe, well known or stranger." And certainly this captures the sentiment that is being expressed in Psalm 46. So he is our refuge. He is the one that we go to. He is the one that we look for to help and to be there and to shield us from the things that are happening in the world. The second thing is, he is our strength. Once again, the Septuagint chose dunamis to translate this Hebrew word, strength. God is our strength. He is our power. We have no power at all in comparison to God. And by the way, neither do our enemies. He is our strength. Remember that Israel did not conquer the land by their own might. God is the one who conquered the land for them, and they would not keep it by their own might either. And sometimes God had to impress this point upon his people because they got to thinking, due to their great success, that it had something to do with them. But no, it was God's doing. They would have never dwelt in Canaan if God had not conquered the land for them. So he is our strength as well as our refuge. And then third, he is a help in trouble. The troubles may be those of a natural order, such as the recent hurricane that came through Florida, or one of a national or political nature, as in conflict with one's neighbors. Israel was in such a location, they had to be sure they weren't going to be attacked from the south by Egypt. They had to be sure they weren't going to be attacked from the north by Assyria or Syria or Babylon or any other nations that happened to have designs like Greece would later on. They always had the potential of trouble. And so God is their help in trouble. We must realize, as they did, that those who fight against us are also fighting against God. Those who denounce the Lord's church, those who would keep us from doing what we ought to do, those who would issue forth different ideologies than what God has given us, they are not just our enemies, they are God's enemies. Those today promoting abortion and homosexuality have made themselves God's enemies. We ought to get into the habit of looking at those who are pro these things, pro Planned Parenthood, pro abortion, pro homosexuality, and in our minds, right underneath their faces, enemy of God, because that's what they are. But we are not afraid of them because God is our help. So he always fights against those who oppose him. And so that's what we need to realize, that we're not like Israel as the church. We're not worried about this nation and that nation coming and conquering us. But we are worried about conflicts with the world. We are worried about conflicts with secular humanism. We are worried about conflicts with worldliness. God is our help in dealing with all of those things. Now, you may have noticed I left out a word. God is not only a help, he is a present help. We may not always see what the Almighty in his providence is doing, but you can rely on the fact that he is not asleep and he is watching out for our good. And as we talked about this morning, God spared not the angels who sinned, the world that was destroyed by water, the communities of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim. People may think that false teachers are not going to be punished, but they are. That's Peter's point in what we were talking about this morning. He is a present help. And so he will be doing something concerning these matters. So all of verse 1 remains true, even with the earth changes in the earth. But let's read verses 2 and 3. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. Now, these would seem to be natural calamities, upheavals that take place in the earth, or these catastrophes could describe physical upheaval, national upheaval, political conflict, as when they're attacked by another nation. But God is mindful of all those things. And let's look at the next verse. There is a river whose stream shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High. So we come to that verse now from which this question arose. And so far, the psalm has dealt with what seemed to be like earthly matters, and there's no reason to suspect a change here, and that's why we fairly well think that he's talking about not the church and not heaven, but the city of Jerusalem. Well, we need to ask ourselves, what is the significance of the water that is mentioned in this verse? When a city is under siege, the water supply is critical. It's crucial. The defense, those defending the city, in this case Jerusalem, the city of God, they would have to be able to have a supply of water and a supply of food. The water is even more critical, though. They have to have water in order to survive. Thus, the city as God is Jerusalem. The church does not need a physical stream, but in connection with it and the city of God in heaven, we read about the water of life. Jesus mentioned that to the woman at the well, the water of life, John 4 and verse 14. It's mentioned three times toward the very end of the book of Revelation. The water of life flowing from the throne of God, chapter 21:6, 22:1, and verse 17. So there is a stream in heaven, but it will be a spiritual stream, and there will not be any assaults made upon the city of God. This is something that they had to worry about in Jerusalem. But I don't read anywhere in the scriptures where anybody's going to try to assault heaven. All of those who would do so have been judged and have been cast into the lake of fire. That lake of fire is described in Revelation 20, verse 10. We read that this morning. And all of these other verses are from Revelation 21, 6 and chapter 22. So, we are not anticipating any kind of an uprising against heaven when God allows us in to live there. So Jerusalem, the church, and heaven can all be referred to as the city of God, but in the context, it would seem to refer to the literal city of Jerusalem in Psalm 46 and verse 4. At the time of this writing, the temple buildings were in existence. God dwelt in the holy place. And so these are sort of markers for us to figure out when this is describing. Now let's look at verse 5. Psalm 46 and verse 5. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her. Just as the break of dawn. The first statement of verse 5 obviously applies to all three cities. God is in her midst. You could say that of Jerusalem. You could say that of the church. You could say that of heaven. But then the focus narrows back to Jerusalem again, and pretty much it would only apply to Jerusalem. When God fights for Israel, she will not be moved. He helps, and right early. Right early is one possible translation of the Hebrew. The Hebrew is literally in the faces of the morning, or in the turning of the morning, according to Young's literal translation. In other words, there's that time of day when the darkness begins to turn into the morning. And God is helping at that particular time. Right early is used by the King James and the American Standard. The New King James has the break of dawn, and the New American Standard and English Standard are when morning dawns. So even though they all more or less convey the same idea, I like it expressed best as when morning dawns, or at the break of dawn. Now this phrase is tied in with Isaiah chapter 37 and verse 36 by most scholars, which makes this very interesting because it's not all that clear from reading this, but let's look at Isaiah 37 and 36 and you'll see why it's tied in. In chapter 37 and verse 36, "Then the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when the people arose early in the morning, at the turning of the morning, there were all corpses." They were all dead. Now, to what event does this refer? The upheavals described certainly in the earth earlier in the psalm, remember all of those natural disasters and things, they could certainly refer to Sennacherib and how he had been conquering the earth. He had just marched through several territories, and including Samaria, or Israel, the northern kingdom, and now he was down outside of Jerusalem knocking on their door and anticipating conquering them. Let's refresh our memories by reading a few verses from Isaiah 37 to see how this got to be where we are in the text. Chapter 37, beginning with verse 8. "So the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah. And Isaiah said to them, 'Thus shall you say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid of the words which you have heard, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me.'" Remember what we said about the enemies of God fighting against God? "Surely I will send a spirit upon him, and he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. So the Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria warring against Libna, for he had heard that he had departed from Lachish. And the king heard concerning Tirhakah, the king of Ethiopia, he has come out to make war with you." In other words, he was focused on trying to assault and conquer Jerusalem, but he got word of other peoples coming out to face him, so he changed his plans. "So when he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah, saying..." Now, remember, he's had to change his plans. He still plans to annihilate Jerusalem, but he's had to change his plans. So he sends this message in verse 10. "Thus shall you say to Hezekiah, king of Judah, saying, do not let your God in whom you trust deceive you, saying, Jerusalem will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Look, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the lands by utterly destroying them. And will you be delivered? Have the gods of the nations delivered those whom my fathers have destroyed, Gozan and Haran and Rezeph and the people of Eden who were in Telassar? Where is the king of Hamath, the king of Arpad, and the king of the city of Sepharvaim, Hena, and Iva. Well, he's right as far as past history goes. They had conquered all of those people. They had shaken up the earth. They had swallowed all of these nations. That much was exactly true. But their boast about conquering Jerusalem, that was not going to come about because they had made themselves enemies of God. And Hezekiah, verse 14, received the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up to the house of the Lord and spread it out before the Lord. He spread out the letter so that the Lord would see it. And he prayed to the Lord. And what he prayed about was for their help and recounting what all the king of Assyria had done and how they were threatened by this. So he put that out, and the Lord answered Hezekiah. But here's what he did. God was a very present help, destroying 185,000 Assyrians overnight. In other words, at the break of dawn, at the turn of the morning, King Hezekiah and all Israel saw what the angel of the Lord had done. They saw the results. They didn't see him doing it during the night, but they saw the results of what had been done. And once again, Spurgeon makes these comments. As soon as the first ray of light proclaims the coming day, at the turn of the morning, God's right arm shall be outstretched to his people. We are slow to meet him, but he is never tardy in helping us. Impatience complains of divine delays, but in very deed, the Lord is not slack concerning his promise. Man's haste is often folly, but God's apparent delays are ever wise, and when rightly viewed, are not delays at all. We have to trust that God knows what he's doing. Yes, it looked bad. Yes, they were surrounded, but the Assyrians were the enemies of God. And God is a very present help, sending the angel of the Lord to destroy 185,000 soldiers. And they saw it at the turning of the morning. Let's notice next verses 6 and 7 in Psalm 46. The nations raged, the kingdoms were moved, he uttered his voice, the earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge. Nations may rage, but God is in control. Now let's read verses 8 and 9. Come, behold the works of the Lord, who has made desolations in the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear in two. He burns the chariot in the fire. Nations may rage again, but God is in control. Those nations will not last long. God allowed the wicked Assyrians to take Israel captive, the northern kingdom, because they deserved punishment. Probably so did the other nations that Assyria conquered. But they never thought that the God of heaven was helping them when they conquered all those nations. They thought it was their own might that did it. But God delivered Judah because of the righteousness of King Hezekiah. Because remember, King Hezekiah had instituted all of those reforms and tried to restore the nation to what God had designed it for in the first place. So God takes care of nations that are in opposition to him. They will not last long. Probably there were many bonfires on that morning where they saw all of the dead soldiers. Imagine 185,000 dead soldiers. They probably had to gather them together, burn all of the bodies, the spearows, the arrows, the shields, the chariots. Notice that God did not just take care of them in secret, but all could see the results of what he had done, thus proving he is our refuge and our power or strength and a very present help in trouble. Now let's notice the last two verses, verses 10 and 11. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. So I am your refuge. I am your strength. Be still and know that I am God. Who else could have achieved such a victory for the nation of Israel except God? Who could have done this? How could this have happened? It would not have happened except God is a very present help in time of trouble. God will be in utter control of heaven. All enemies will have been defeated at that time. He is our eternal refuge, and we will enjoy the spiritual heavenly city of God just as much as or more than the Israelites enjoyed Jerusalem, especially as God saved them. When you leave this earth, where will you be going? That's a sobering question, but one we need to all answer. There are only two options: heaven or hell. What will be your final destination? It will be heaven if God has been your refuge and strength and your present help. But if not, if you have relied upon the wisdom of men, if you have relied upon college professors and culture and society and the wisdom of this earth, you won't be going to heaven. So which is the appropriate decision? Which is the right decision? If we can help you make that right decision this evening, let us know. If you're ready to repent of your sins and be buried with Christ in baptism, we're ready to help you. If you're already his child, but maybe you've kind of blurred the lines between these two places. They're not blurred in the scriptures. They may be blurred in your mind. But there is a broad way and a narrow way. And we encourage you to stay on the narrow way. If we can help you, let us know while we stand and while we sing.